Good morning, all. The first case for argument, the United States versus Quinby. Mr. Strang.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This, of course, is a federal felony case arising out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin in which Edward Quinby was convicted under the Deadbeat Parents Punishment Act of 1998, and I speak for him today. What makes the first two constitutional issues that I've raised, I think, both factually and legally interesting here is the setting of this prosecution, which concerned a willfully delinquent father who essentially was stationary. And children who, at the time with their custodial mother, moved to a distant state. This is not fundamentally a situation in which a father, or at least the obligor parent, moved across state lines in an effort, inferable at least, an effort to evade a state judicial order requiring child support. We have a stationary father. He actually at some point moves from Lake County, Illinois, into the adjoining Kenosha County, Wisconsin. But there's no flavor here of an obligor parent who's crossing state lines to defeat or evade the child support obligation. The diversity of citizenship rests on the mother's decision to remove the children to a distant state. I've with that factual background, framed two constitutional issues. The first is equal protection argument. The second, an interstate commerce or commerce clause argument. I'll address.
Well, I was going to say, on putting to one side for the moment the fact that, at least under the predecessor statute, this court has already ruled on something very much like the claims that you're raising, and that the Sixth Circuit has recently, in the majority, rejected your argument. Either way you look at it, Congress surely had a rational basis for distinguishing between the interstate situation, no matter which parent moved, and the in-state situation. There are statements in the legislative history to that effect, and so just maybe for the moment, focusing on the equal protection argument, I don't see where any kind of suspect classification or fundamental interest is involved, and if we're under a rational basis test, this doesn't look like too much of a stretch to me.
The burden on the right to travel freely interstate is...
Well, that's a different issue than an equal protection issue, isn't it?
No, that's under that equal protection doctrine. That's what would justify strict scrutiny, if a fundamental constitutional right is burdened by the classification. I've argued here that there is a fundamental constitutional right to travel from state to state. Now, that may not be the strict scrutiny argument or component of equal protection may not be my strongest argument, because as I say here, it's not my client who traveled. He remained relatively stationary. It was the children who traveled.
But you were arguing, I thought, correct me if I'm wrong about the essence of your argument, I thought you were saying that if we begin with a willfully delinquent parent, the willfully delinquent parent who has children in another state, for whatever reason, he moved, they moved, is vulnerable to a prosecution under a federal statute for a felony, whereas the same willfully delinquent parent with an entirely in-state situation is not. I thought that was what you were
that
saying.
No, Your Honor is exactly correct. And what that means, then, if we posit, as we have to, the starting point as a willfully delinquent parent.
And that's the starting point that the lower court disagreed with you on, in part, right? Because the lower court said he could have paid his child support or gone to the Illinois court and sought an order, you know, relieving him of that obligation if he didn't have enough money or whatever. And it seems to me a lot depends on where we begin.
And you are right, Your Honor, about how the district court saw it. Now, clearly you can look at this statute and say it draws a classification between willfully delinquent parents and parents who aren't willfully delinquent. Well, of course, the latter are never subject to a criminal penalty. But what within the framework of the criminal penalty, where we're always talking about willfully delinquent obligor parents, the classification I'm challenging here is that which makes the parent with in-state children never subject to federal criminal liability, but the parent whose children happen for whatever reason to be in another state, and again, the predicate being willfully delinquent, he or she is subject to the federal criminal penalty.
But you know, that happens in other statutes. For instance, if you commit arson, let's say, on a warehouse, so that we don't have to worry about the residential property issue, it's property used in interstate commerce, clearly, you've committed a federal crime, whereas if you commit arson with other property, it's only a state crime. There's sometimes just the nature of what you've done.
Yes, but what's interesting about this is that it's the actions of a third party, the children, which are beyond the control of the defendant, and which may not have even happened at the time the delinquency arises, that creates the jurisdictional nexus. And that's what's so strange about this and what makes it different than a felon in possession of a gun or an arson of a building involved in interstate commerce. In those situations, the defendant either rightly assumes the risk that there's an interstate commerce connection, and in theory he can know it he knows what building he's burning down, or in fact he's the one who's created the jurisdictional nexus. Here we have the child. For reasons of the child's own or the custodial parent's own, creating the jurisdictional hook, as the government and the court below called it, that completes the possibility of a federal criminal prosecution.
Why isn't that as foreseeable, Mr. Strang, as the committing arson on the
because it may
in
not
a divorce setting, I mean, in a modern mobile society?
Judge Fong, because it may not have even happened at the time the delinquency arises. And the children may move after the delinquency arises. Now, I think as this jury was instructed, they were told to find that during the entire period charged in the indictment, the children, in fact, were out of state, and indeed we stipulated that the children, in fact, were out of state. But the delinquency far preceded here, and in many cases would, the children's move, and indeed the parent may not have even known that the children were moved or being moved out of state. So it's a curious kind of problem, and I think an irrational place for Congress to draw the line. Now, Judge Wood, I want to go back to your question.
Okay, I was just going to say, though, you're not contesting that he knew they were going to go to Tennessee. Wasn't that actually
in the divorce documents, it contemplated that the wife and the children would move to Tennessee.
So we don't have before us a case where this happens, you know, utterly without his knowledge.
Right, although that was in 1989. Where they went after that, he had no way to know because the wife or the ex-wife just cut off his contact with the children. But
of course, the problem Congress was trying to get at was the practical problem of interstate obligation enforcement. Is that legitimate for Congress to worry about?
And that goes back to Your Honor's first question, which is, if Congress wants to reach this, it's got its Commerce Clause limitations to worry about. So isn't it rational, then, to define a statute that turns on a nexus to interstate commerce? And at one level, yes. You know, but I struggle with that because there's something I can't get my arms around entirely about saying that we can create a classification or a distinction that's I think wobbly, even under a rational basis test, in order to avoid a constitutional limitation elsewhere in a field that we have no duty to regulate in at all. Judge Batchelder, in her dissent in Fossey, accused the majority of resorting to reasoning that went, if we had some ham, we could make a ham sandwich if we had some bread. Now, I'm not sure that's exactly the problem, but I'm struggling with it. Because, yes, of course, at one level, it's rational for Congress to write legislation that avoids a constitutional limitation it would know.
But the other way of looking at that, I mean, that sort of glass is half empty approach. I mean, Judge Moore, in her opinion, in the Sixth Circuit, and I think the way Congress might have been looking at it, is we realize we can't solve the whole problem of delinquent parents. Part of it is intrastate. Part of it is within the traditional powers of the state. But interstate commerce is clearly affected by the flow of money that goes with this. There are all kinds of ancillary consequences, so let's address the part we can.
That is, and that's probably a good segue into into interstate commerce, and I don't want to overlook that. We have the author of Black with us this morning. And I think the problem with Black, and it's also a problem with the Fossey majority, although Fossey tries to hedge its bets by putting this in at least two and maybe all three of the Lopez categories, unlike the decision in Black. But the problem there are a number of problems, but one of them is that once this court accepts the proposition that a legal obligation or a court-ordered debt, you know, a court obligation, becomes subject to federal authority if there's diversity of citizenship. And
well, is that what they're saying? They're really saying if there's an interstate flow to the payment, right?
Fossey involved non-payment, just like this case does. And Fossey's a little hard on this. Are they talking about the payment, or are they talking about the obligation to pay? Depending on where you look in Judge Moore's opinion, she's talking about both, I think.
Probably, yeah.
But I think that this court in Black was talking about the obligation as the thing being in commerce. Although the court then also said, it doesn't matter if it's just electrons moving across state lines, which suggests that maybe the court also was talking about the payment. If it's talking about the payment, we run into the fact that this punishes non-payment. I mean, it's the absence of interstate commerce. It's, if it were Heart of Atlanta, it's the hotel that never opens at all, rather than the hotel that opens but turns away Black travelers. What I want to say about Black is, though, at a general level, I have conceded all along that the 1992 Act is not distinguishable from the 1998 Act at its most general level. They both turn on diversity of citizenship. Factually, Black is different, and also the court has to consider that Morrison came down after Black. Factually, the reason that they're different is that both fathers, and they were fathers in Black, on the facts, left state, skipped state. Indeed, one of the fathers in Black said, "I'm going to Texas because they won't be able to track me down there. I'll beat my child support obligation that way." They both were prosecuted under the 1992 Act, but if they'd been prosecuted after June of 1998, those guys would have been good candidates for subsection A2 here, which first created the crime of yourself crossing interstate lines to evade, willfully to evade, the obligation. That's, of course, not what Quinzing was charged with. He's charged under A3, which rings of the old 1992 Act. There was no A2 or any analog to it back under the 1992 Act, but factually, that's what those guys did. And there, you've got a much better argument for a federal exercise of jurisdiction, because you even can say, arguably there, that it's that now the father or the delinquent parent is a person in commerce, in interstate commerce. That's what he's doing. So I think factually, if this court wanted to distinguish Black, it could. And Morrison also substantially undercuts both the legislative history and the rationale here when it rejects the cost of crime theory of interstate commerce connection to violent crime. This isn't violent, but the rationale Congress gives sounds a lot like the cost of crime. I'll save rebuttal time such as I have.
Thank you, Mr. Strang. Ms. Warwick?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Lisa Warwick, an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I was also a trial counsel on this case. As Mr. Strang has already noted, there are three issues raised in the brief of the appellant, two constitutional, having to do with the DPPA, and the third having to do with the business records exception amendment. As to the constitutional arguments, as to the Commerce Clause, I would rest upon my brief unless there are distinct questions from this panel. I believe that Black has spoken on that very issue. The DPPA, for purposes of this analysis, is not distinguishable from the CSRA, and therefore the analysis still applies. We have 10 other circuits that have upheld this predecessor statute under a Commerce Clause challenge, and that Black continues to be sound reasoning.
Well, I did have a question about that, though. Mr. Strang mentioned right at the end, in fact, the point that had occurred to me, which is that we have from the Supreme Court the intervening decision in Morrison, which follows and perhaps expands on the Lopez line of cases and signals to me, anyway, that the court is really trying to take a much stricter look at these Commerce Clause-based statutes than had once been the case. Black certainly predates Morrison, and we can't tell the Supreme Court they're wrong, so should we reconsider it in light of Morrison?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I reread Morrison again this morning, and I believe there where you're dealing with a federal civil liability statute. And the court, I think, was very clear that they looked at something almost as if you would drop arrows to it. You had a civil liability or a civil offense liability, violence, and then violent behavior resulted in something else. And they looked at it, I think, as being very attenuated, that the economic impact was too far away, and that argument could go to everything. And so therefore, you're implicating Commerce Clause as a basis to just put your hands over everything. And I don't think that this statute does that. There is the Congress looking at the direct economic impact on delinquent parents not paying their child support. And so I think that it's not an attenuated thing, that violent crime, therefore, could lead to other aspects of society having to pick up the tab or other things. I think that what I read in Morrison, too, was that when they looked at Lopez, they followed that line of reasoning to say that that was the problem with Lopez, because you had the gun on the school, but then you had to go too many steps away from it to get to an economic impact related to that. And I don't think you have that with this statute. So I don't believe that Morrison should cause any of the circuits, this one included, to revisit Black to such an extent that you would change the reasoning, change the mind, and result with a different outcome. I think this court is right that when you're looking at what's at issue here, it's a thing in interstate commerce. That second prong is met. There was also alluded to within the Black opinion that perhaps the statute could meet all three prongs of Lopez, although that wasn't then gone into full-blown discussion.
And so could I understand from what you're saying, then, that you don't think that there really is a meaningful distinction between payments that do flow in interstate commerce and actions taken to impede the flow of a payment, you know, the non-payment issue that Mr. Strang raises?
A meaningful distinction? A meaningful distinction for terms of upholding the statute?
Right. Can Congress pass a statute that basically says the purpose of this statute is to make sure that interstate commerce keeps on flowing and doesn't get plugged up somewhere by somebody's refusal to pay?
I think that that's rational, advisable, and constitutional. Because as many of the opinions have stated, the impact is direct to the custodial parent, the non-obligor parent. When those payments don't come, where is he or she going to go? Well, hopefully to a job that can sustain some sort of viability at a standard of living. If that's not the case, then we have the federal treasury potentially implicated. So we have a problem then with the impact on interstate commerce is direct because you have that person maybe at a lesser standard of living implicating the federal treasury, implicating interstate commerce because they're not consuming the goods. You know, I guess the converse argument means, but yes, you have the non-custodial parent with the money spending
in
somewhere
the economy
else.
Right.
Well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But yeah. But that would be the point.
I don't think Mr. Clinton was, but we'll see.
No, I don't think so either. At least we didn't find as such.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no more questions on the Commerce Clause, then as to the equal protection argument, the government is very firm that this is a rational basis examination. We don't reach the level of strict scrutiny for this type of equal protection argument, and that as applied to this case, the Mr. Singer pointed out, the facts are that Mr. Quincy's travel was not impeded. He could travel freely. It was the anticipated movement of his children, which, as noted, was put in the marital separation agreement. He knew his kids were going to be going to Tennessee with a custodial parent. And, you know, how does the statute come into play? He chooses not to pay his child support. It's not that he can't travel. He can travel anywhere he chooses. But as long as you have that separate state jurisdiction going on, you have to pay. The statute doesn't punish travel. It doesn't burden travel. It punishes and reaches people who choose not to pay willfully. And that's what the statute gets at. The rational basis, pretty much the same argument that the Commerce Clause and that Black reasons as to why Congress enacted this statute. First, because of the burden on the federal treasury program. Second, the rational basis is the problem with Lopez. To have a jurisdictional element, a nexus, right within the statute that you don't have to look layer upon layer in the legislative history to try to figure it out, to try to see if it's there. They put it right up front in the statute.
But isn't there an element in this case, which Mr. Strang, I believe, alludes to in his brief, of the federal government looking for some hook to get into probably the quintessential area that has been left to the states, that is family relationships of all kinds, marriage, divorce, child custody, et cetera. And in a sense, one can read Lopez as the same thing, as kind of a concern with the federalization of traditionally state matters. And is it good enough to say, oh, we found, you know, luckily somebody can sometimes move in interstate commerce. Doesn't matter who, you know, the children can move, the father can move, the mother can move, whoever. But now we have our hook to overcome the federal balance.
Right, and I think the problem that happened with Lopez, as familiar as I am with that case, is that you have the federal government with that attenuated argument on impact on the economy. In the CSRA and the DPPA, you have a direct impact on the economy and potentially the federal government, and that being the Treasury. And those are those programs that are going to be are in place, and they're, you know, whether they're welfare to work programs now, we've gone away from, I think, aid to dependent families, but still programs in place to aid families who aren't at the level that they should be at. And why are they there? Well, some of the reasons that they're there is because child support isn't being paid. You then look beyond that to why did the states have a problem with this. And I think the Black even points out that even though you have a Uniform Reciprocal Act to aid states to get the support orders enforced, there is so much wrangling, there is so much red tape, there are so many black holes in child support enforcement offices that the burden fell upon the Treasury to make up for the gap. So because the federal government can be directly impacted, you have a much more direct link again to what is federal in this as opposed to Lopez. You don't have to take the leaps. It's right there. The statistics were spelled out in, I believe, the House reports as to the level of poverty, the number of families that were not getting the proper payments from the non-custodial parents. So I think it's direct.
Is it legitimate for Congress to pass a statute that's just frankly designed to assist the states in their law enforcement efforts?
No, I think there has to be a rational basis. There has to be some reason.
They have to make up some federal interest, too. They can't just say, you know, we can see that it's 50 different states. These reciprocal acts can only go so far. We will just step in.
Right. I don't think
that's not good
that.
Enough. Okay.
No, I don't think so. I don't know how much time I have left, but I'll move on to the business records exception. In this case, the amendment to the business record exception, 8036, came about in 2000. The government proposed to put in various business-related documents in the course of the trial through the business record exception, through a certification document, basically following the language of the rule, spelling out information as to the records custodian, the litany that often is heard by the custodian when they're testifying at trial. The judge did his job in this case. The judge looked at all the documents that the government wished to have moved into evidence pursuant to the certification and didn't allow some in.
He excluded quite a bit, actually.
He excluded quite a bit. You're exactly right. And the only ones out of the bunch that he thought were inherently reliable because of the nature of what they are the Form W-2s. So he let the Form W-2s into evidence. There were objections along the way as to not the nature of the documents themselves, but the method, the methodology of getting them in. The government believes that at the outset and overall in this, that the amendment withstands a Confrontation Clause challenge. This amendment is based on the foreign records exception. And the foreign records exception was an avenue of facilitating the process of getting records in without the cost and burden of bringing in a foreign witness who would certify to those documents much the way that someone testifying would do.
But of course, in the foreign records exception instance, your unavailability argument for the custodian is a pretty powerful one. If they're in another country, that's usually enough to show that a witness is unavailable, right?
Right.
And so one could say that in our traditional approaches to the use of hearsay, taking a good second best is all right if the witness is unavailable. Domestic custodian, you can't say that about. And what I want to know is whether you understand the quote, firmly rooted idea as something that goes only to the underlying nature of the evidence, such as business records, for example, because it seems to me that's what you're arguing, or do you think it goes also to the way you prove it? Because what has happened here is a change in the mechanism of authenticating, but not a change in the evidence that actually finally comes in.
Right. I believe that it almost seems a little bit of a circular argument. You start out with 8036, a firmly rooted exception. Then the foreign records exception, based on that, allowing for a change to the methodology, the mechanism by where you get it in.
Right.
Then you end up with the amendment, which goes back around.
Right.
So it's kind of a bizarre end around. But I guess the way that I would answer that is the firmly rooted exception to 8036 has to do with what are you trying to get into evidence, what are these documents, and also has the catch-all that the judge has to make the decision at all times, are these inherently trustworthy, has to do that analysis. And I think that keeping that as part of the analysis that the judge has to perform, whether I'm bringing a record custodian in to testify or whether the government's trying to do it through the business record certification, is really the linchpin in this. I can't say enough that the judge did the right thing in this case, and the rule allows for that. I won't say that, the defendant could have brought the custodian in, because that doesn't really meet the Confrontation Clause argument, although, mm-hmm. albeit that was true. I guess to skip a little ahead to the harmless and error analysis, if this court should find somehow that this was in violation, in this case, of a confrontation right of the defendant, that this was harmless error. These were 404B evidence. The time frame on the W-2s was outside of the time frame charged in the indictment. The defendant never had an objection to the relevance of these documents. That was not the point.
Before you go on with that, could you answer one question? Suppose somebody looks at one of these certifications, and it's not something like W-2s that we all are probably familiar with, and genuine questions do arise in a person's mind about whether this is the kind of record that ought to be given business record treatment. There's a mechanism, right, for going beyond that certification.
You could bring the records custodian in.
Yeah, but the other person then has to challenge the certification, right? They have
right.
to say, I'm not, here's what I think is wrong with it. They've got to sort of take another affirmative step that they wouldn't have had to take before.
Right, and I think that what, again, is important within the rule is the proponent of the evidence has to give notice ahead of time.
Right.
And that's why in this case, when the government gave its notice, it was providing not only notice, but here's the certification, here are the records, so that everybody's up front, so that you don't run into any delays at trial. What you don't want to have happen is spring this on somebody. There is a problem. You really want to get them in. You've got to scramble now to get the record custodian or to modify your certification.
Well, right, because the certification can be challenged at that point before the trial.
Absolutely. And that was the judge's point, too, upon looking at these documents. If he provided sufficient opportunity to the government that should we want to pursue those particular items that he excluded, we could either modify the certification or bring in the records custodian. We chose to simply go with the items that he decided were allowable under the amendment to the rule. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I would complete my argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ward. Mrs. Kang.
2 points. First, the district judge's exclusion of many of those records demonstrates the government's failure to show the reliability of the rest of them. The excluded documents came under the same certifications and clearly shouldn't have been certified. They weren't business records, and therein, in addition to the reissued by employer stamp, I think is the government's failing as the proponent to show reliability. Second, crime costs money. It just does, and that doesn't make crime commercial. Morrison specifically warns about domestic relations and divorce as an area into which Congress ought not venture under the Commerce Clause. Thanks.
Thank you, Strang. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.